Mr. Macy relates.
Yes, as I say, there was this whacking great hole that you could get a wheelbarrow through. Now, apparently what had happened, I discovered after talking to those concerned, was that they'd cut the hole in the wire. Freedom was staring them in the face. When, lo and behold, one of the guards came along, he got taken short. He moved away from the wire, down pants, squatted away, looking at the wire, and he must have seen that it wasn't quite as it should be. So he up nicks quicker than that, went over to the wire, discovered this whacking great hole, and he immediately alerted the goon boxes, who, of course, alerted the camp commandant and all the rest out in the German Vorlager. And that is what happened. Their escape attempt was foiled by a German guard being taken short. Which is why I say 99.9% luck. There was freedom staring them in the face. Outdoor activities in the camp. Well, we used to have leagues for rugby and football, baseball and athletics. And I won a medal, actually, for football. We had a football league there. I played for Millwall and we won the league. Rugby was quite popular too, because, as I said a little earlier on, all these camps were built on sand. So that when blokes were brought down and there were scrums and all that sort of thing, they didn't get too badly hurt as you do normally in rugby on a hard ground. Now, in the camp were a few Americans, and I feel that I must say something about this, because the few Americans that we had in there were very well supplied by the American Red Cross with just about everything they needed. In fact, every one of them had 8 different uniforms. Their Red Cross parcels, or American Red Cross parcels, always came through. They always had plenty of mail. They always had plenty of cigarettes. But never, on one occasion, did they ever give any of their possessions away to people more in need of something than themselves. They didn't mix with us. They didn't fraternize with us. They didn't take any interest in anything that was going on in the camp. They kept themselves strictly to themselves. In other words, they might just as well have been surrounded with barbed wire inside barbed wire. And when British airmen were shot down out of the skies on their Hamburg raids and Bremen raids, we did get planes shot down from time to time. They used to come down, and the airmen were brought into the camp, and everybody rushed to lash them up with razor blades or a bit of clothing, make a brew of tea or coffee or something like that, and try and make them feel at home. Not the Americans. Strictly out of it. Didn't want to know. Wouldn't give a thing. I'm afraid that my opinion of Americans changed there and then, and never have I changed them since. People always talk about their being so hail fellow well met, so hospitable and all the rest of it. Maybe they are, outside of barbed wire. But behind barbed wire, no, sir, they are not. And none of them ever attempted to escape, to my knowledge. But as I say, the main thing was they wouldn't mix with us, they wouldn't take part in anything. They just didn't want to know.
Did you find that their attitude towards the Germans was any different from that of the British?
No. They didn't mix with the Germans as we did. They didn't bait them as we did. They kept themselves strictly to themselves and strictly out of trouble. They just didn't want to be mixed up in anything.
Were there any other nationalities there besides
Americans? Not in Marlag, no. No, not in Marlag. At one period, towards the end of the war, we heard about a British Free Corps and that they were sending some of their representatives to the camp to try and persuade us to join the British Free Corps. Now, this, as far as I can remember, had been brought into being by the Germans, who had persuaded a lot of our prisoners of war to set up this British Free Corps and cooperate with them. And it was supposed to be a peace movement. And they had supplied these chaps with wine, women and song to encourage them and recruit them. And they were sending these chaps round to various camps to try and get more recruits to sort of make representations to the British government to call off the war and to say that the Germans were really nice people and we ought to, instead of fight them, be friendly with them. Well, now, we heard that these British Free Corps people were coming to the camp. And we didn't go much on this, and we said, no way are they coming in here. Can you... these chaps duly turned up at the camp, and the Germans brought them into the Vorlager, and they brought one lot of them over to our compound, and the other lot over to the officers' compound. Now, no way were we going to allow those British Free Corps chaps into our compound. And we all went down to the gates, barricaded the gates. The Germans couldn't get them open. We wouldn't let them in. So in desperation, they threw bundles of pamphlets over the wire of the gate. Well, most of the pamphlets were thrown back again. But I and a few others managed to get one. And they are now contained, or that is now contained in my war log. But no way would we let those chaps in there. And we told the senior British officer, Captain Baker, before they came, that we wouldn't be responsible for their safety if they came in through those gates. No way would they leave it, that compound. And the officers gave them the same treatment, I'm glad to say. They couldn't get in there either.
Was there any suggestion that this British Free Corps was to fight against the Russians?
Yes, there was. That's quite true. I'd forgotten that point. There was.
You said that quite a few, the Germans had managed to persuade quite a few people to join. Did you get an idea of the numbers?
How many? No. We never knew how many there were. We understood that there were quite a lot who had taken up this offer from the Germans, but I never knew how many.
How many people appeared at the gate?
There were about a dozen altogether. About six of them came to our gate and six went to the officers' gate. But no way were they coming in, or even if they'd come in, they wouldn't have got out. We were in that sort of mood.
Did they seem to be officers or other ranks?
No, other ranks. That's the impression we gained. Certainly not officers. They didn't appear to be officer material at all.
Were they army or not?
Yes, I think they were. They were certainly dressed in battle dress. But then so was every prisoner of war. You couldn't really tell. But I would have said that they were army. I couldn't see anybody in the Navy doing that. vegetable growing. We did have little plots of vegetables. The Red Cross used to send us seeds through, and we used to cultivate little plots of flowers and cabbage and tomatoes and things like that, which helped pass a bit of time, and of course it was profitable. In early 1945, they filled up the third compound, which was known as ELAG, with internees in from France. And included in these internees was a full BBC orchestra. They'd been playing in Berlin when war broke out. And, of course, the Germans rounded them up and interned them, carted them into France, and then eventually, as our people worked through France, so they were transported and they clued up in ELAG next to our compound. Now, in that orchestra was their pianist, was Frankie Still. And he wrote the music for a Christmas pantomime of ours called Robinson Crusoe. And one of the songs that he wrote for it was, and you may have heard it, I'm Looking Over a Four-Leaf Clover. Whenever I hear that song on the radio, I think back to the days of who wrote it, when it was written, and how it was written, and for what for and under what circumstances. But that's where that song came from. After the war, Frankie Still became a pianist to Suzette Terry, and they were touring the music halls. I met them, him after the war in the Empire in Chatham, the theatre there, and we nattered about old times. There was also a harmonica player in this setup, and that was Tommy Riley. You may have heard of him, you may not. But I met him again after the war in the Theatre Royal in Chatham. And I went back stage and we had a chat in his dressing room about old times. But they used to keep us entertained. And there were about 500 of these people that had been brought in from France and put into ELAG. If I remember rightly, and you know, a strange thing was that we heard that one of them was a French count, and his grand piano had been transported as well. I could hardly believe it, but this is what we were told. And when they came, the Germans didn't seem to mind us fraternizing with them at all. In fact, old Frankie Still and one or two members of the orchestra and Tommy Riley, they were allowed to come over to us to help with this Robinson Crusoe panto. No bother at all. And then early in 1945, the chiefs and POs in our compound were whipped out, taken over the fore lager and put in with the officers. And the reason for that will become clear when I come up and talk again. It concerns the force march that took place from April onwards until our release in Lübeck.
Before we finish, yes? Can I just ask you about one thing which you mentioned earlier when you were in Lambsdorff, I think it was. You said that you refused to go out on a work party, citing the Geneva Conventions regarding NCOs. Why was it that you didn't want to go out to work?
Why was it? Because I was a petty officer, and under the Geneva Conventions, they couldn't make me go out to work. No way was I going out to work. That is what the Geneva Conventions said. And that is what I considered should happen. The Geneva Convention says name, rank and official number is all you should tell your captors. That's all they got. You've got to stick to the book. You can't keep sort of diversifying from it.
Because I was thinking some people decided to go out on them because of the perquisites they could get, as it were.
That is true. Oh, yeah, the junior rates, they were all for going out on working parties for that reason. Yes, quite true. But we were senior rates, supposed to set an example. The Geneva Convention said no. So now it was to be.
I was also interested in this other thing you mentioned earlier, that about your knowledge of the gas chambers in view of what was said by Germans after the war, that they were ignorant about what was happening to Jews and so on. And I wondered how much you'd got to know about this type of thing.
Yeah, we didn't hear much, but we had heard rumours that this was taking place. I mean, people were travelling around Germany. There were working parties, particularly in Namsdorf. They were coming and going. And although perhaps the majority of Germans didn't know this was taking place, I can't honestly believe that really and truly that a lot of them didn't. And with prisoners out on working parties, what would you do if you were one? You would be talking to the Germans, the same as I'm talking to you now. If you were out on a working party, the same as I did talk to them in the next tapes that we shall be doing. And information got around like this. It wasn't printed in the papers, obviously, but by word of mouth. And when they came back in from their working parties, or moved from one camp to another, the information went with them, and it was passed on like that. And we got to hear about this. And then, of course, it made us wonder what was coming out of those things up there. Not a very nice experience, really. Now, in very early August 1944, two guards suddenly appeared at the door of my room and asked me to accompany them. My mind was in a whirl. It was going round in small circles because I couldn't understand why they wanted to take me away or even where I was going to. However, I went with them, trying to puzzle out what it could be all about. I was taken out of the compound, across the German Vorlager, into the officers' compound and into the hut of the senior British officer, Captain Baker. And I was taken into his room and stood before him, and he said, "Well, Macy, I've got some very bad news for you from the Red Cross." He said, "They've received a cable from your family to say that your father died on the 17th of July this year. And the Red Cross have written to me and asked me to pass that news on to you, which I am doing. And here is the letter which they've sent to me." That letter is contained in my wartime log, which is in the Department of Documents. Until then, I had no inkling that my father was even ill. Now, following on from this, I think I ought to say something about the effect that it had on me. Obviously, I was absolutely shaken to the core to get this news. And that evening, I wandered about the compound and I was soundly cursing the barbed wire that I couldn't get through to get home to see my family. And I'm afraid that I broke down. I just sat down on the ground and cried my heart out. Maybe it was a womanish thing to do, but quite frankly, I don't think it was in the situation in which I found myself. I just could not do anything about it. Well, now, I got a letter towards the end of August from my mother saying that my father was dying. And then I got another letter from my wife saying that she was going to buy the house in which my sister was living, which my father had bought for my sister up in Rochester, so that I had a home to come home to when I did eventually get home. Well, now, mail was very erratic in Marlag from time to time. And as a pointer to this, a letter which was written in August 44 concerning my father's death reached me in February 45. It took that long. And this was not unusual. Ordinary mail was all over the place. Some got through all right, other there was long delays, very long delays, such as in that case. However, I think that's enough about that subject. We'll go on to goon baiting. Of course, we had a lot of fun with goon baiting. One of the things that we used to do when we met guards, when we were perambulating round the camp, was to give them the Heil Hitler salute. And of course, they were so ingrained with Hitlerism that they just automatically gave it back. Didn't realise until they'd done it how silly they looked. Another thing that we used to do when we saw guards approaching was the German goose step. And of course, this used to make them mad, so that sometimes we had to move pretty fast to get out of the way. And then we used to bait them too, as well, with kicking a football over the tripwire. Now, there was a tripwire about 12 feet from the main barbed wire. This tripwire was about 3 feet high. We used to, three or four of us used to take a football out and start kicking it around, and it would go over the tripwire. So then we had to go up to the goon box and ask them if we could go over the tripwire to get our football back. And we used to carry this on and on for 10 minutes, perhaps 15 minutes, until the goon up in his box got really fed up with it, realised he was being taken for a ride, swung his gun round so that we had to pack up. And then when it came to appel or roll call, some of us, well, an odd one here and there, used to run up and down the back rank. Now, the Germans, for some unknown reason, could only seem to count in threes. So we all had to line up in columns of three. Now, if somebody ran up the back after he'd been counted and made an extra one on the end, when the Feldwebel went over to the officer in charge and gave the numbers, of course, they were up the creek. It would be one, two, maybe three, more than there should be. By this time, the chap had run back to where his normal place was. The Germans had to start counting all over again. Eins, zwei, drei, vier, fünf, and away they went. And we used to keep this up two or three times until perhaps they saw someone moving and then realised they were being taken for a ride. But, go on.
Could I interrupt at this yes. point just to ask about this term goon? Did it mean precisely German or did it mean guard?
It's just a name that we gave them.
But did it apply just to the guards or to German civilians as well?
Oh, no, not to German civilians. No, just to the guards. Oh, yes.
And it wasn't just a word that the RAF used then, it was a word common to all POWs.
Yes, it was used in all POW camps, yes. Now, in circumstances in which we found ourselves, it was very necessary to have a strong sense of humour. You had to find the funny, or see the funny side of things. If you didn't have a sense of humour, and I've seen this happen, it did seem to affect people's brains. They would sit glassy-eyed on their bunks for hours on end, not interested in anything or anyone. They just sat there, looking into space. This is one of the reasons why I took up amateur operatics and dramatics, because I realised that unless I did something to keep my mind active, I was going to become like one of them, more or less a cabbage. So I went onto the stage, trod the boards, call it what you will, to keep my mind alive. And, of course, we got a lot of fun out of that sort of thing. And this helped to keep the sense of humour alive. Now, We were allowed to send out cards and letters. And when I was first caught in Italy, I wondered how the devil I was going to celebrate, if you like to put it that way, my wife's birthday, our wedding anniversary, and Christmas. And I hit on the idea of sending a card to a firm which was then called Post Roses. And I said that from time to time I would be sending them cards well in advance of the anniversary and ask them to send a dozen red roses to my wife and to send the account to the Director of Navy Accounts at the Admiralty, where I presume our pay documents were kept while we were behind barbed wire. And this they did faithfully right throughout the time I was a prisoner of war.
And did the Navy meet the bill?
Yes. Oh, yes. They met the bill all right. It was all laid on. It was very good. Now, from time to time, over the years since I've been home and I've been talking to people and spinning yarns and one thing and the other, they've said to me, well, now, how did you get on in view of the fact that you were not involved or in any way connected with women? You had a lack of female company, in other words. Did homosexuality raise its ugly head in the prison camps? Well, I never found this, strangely enough, until I got to Marlag, where I discovered that anyone who went on the stage was automatically considered to be a homosexual. One morning in my own room, one of my own shipmates called me a brown hatter, which is naval slang for a homosexual. I immediately rushed across the room, hauled him out of his bunk, and started to lay into him. Of course, we were pulled apart. But he never, and no one else, ever accused me of being a homosexual because I used to go on the stage. And I was always cast as a female lead, which was what gave him the idea, I suppose, in the first place. But there was an outstanding example of homosexuality in this particular camp, and I must record this because it's almost unbelievable. There was in the camp a sick berth petty officer who was an acknowledged homosexual. He was the passive partner. His active partner was a Royal Marine. They had a double-tiered bunk, and they used an old blanket as a curtain on this for their operations. Now, both these chaps were nice chaps. The sick berth petty officer, whose name I can't remember, he used to be mixed up with amateur dramatics and operatics and stage work and that sort of thing. Well, being a sick berth petty officer, of course, he was classified by the Geneva Convention as a non-combatant, and therefore he could be repatriated, all the same as a chaplain. Well, in about the middle of 1944, lo and behold, his name was on the list for repatriation. The day came along, and he left the camp to go to Gothenburg to be put on a ship and exchanged and go home. About a week later, we saw two guards and a Kriege walking down the road from Dulag towards Marlag. And as they got nearer, we recognised that it was this sick berth petty officer. And we couldn't believe our eyes. We all thought he was on the high seas on his way to UK and home. He came in the camp, and we said, well, what the hell went wrong? Why aren't you on the way home? What happened? And he said, I got to Gothenburg. I got on the jetty. I just could not face leaving my friend. So I've come back to the prison camp.